State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
It was her fault. Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have a sunny day today. They say tomorrow, maybe not so much, but we'll take what we get day by day, right? Okay, it looks like you have your usual time allocations. So I'll call the first case, State versus CLK. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed? Thank you. Please do.
Good morning. Mr. Westfall, please the court. My name is Jeffrey Jensen.
Counsel, if you would make sure to speak up, I would appreciate it.
My name is Jeffrey Jensen, and I represent the respondent, appellant, petitioner, C.K. C.K. is a father who had his parental rights ordered terminated by the circuit court on a petition filed by the state alleging that he had abandoned his children. C.K. contested that petition. Eventually, he waived his right to a jury trial, and the case was presented to the court. At the court trial, the only witness that the state called was C.K. adversely. And C.K. was questioned by the assistant district attorney and also by his own attorney, and then after C.K. was finished testifying, the state rested. The party's defense counsel included began arguing what the judge eventually called an implicit motion for a directed verdict. And when it became apparent to the defense lawyer that the court may in fact be granting a motion for a directed verdict, defense counsel said, well, then I would like to finish my case and present the rest of the evidence before you do that. The judge didn't allow him to do that and instead found that grounds existed to terminate CK's parental rights. One of the criteria under 809.62 for Supreme Court review is whether an opinion of the Supreme Court will help clarify, harmonize, and develop the law. So the issue that's presented to the court, in my opinion, is extremely straightforward. The question is whether, I think we all agree it is, in fact, error for the circuit court to have granted a directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case. But the issue for this appeal is whether that error is structural error or whether it's subject to the harmless error rule. Again, everybody agrees that's a question of law. And in my opinion, when something is a question of law, the Supreme Court decides that really without much reference at all to what the facts of the case are, which is why Ms. C.K. proposes a very simple rule that will clarify, harmonize, and develop the law. It's a rule that can be applied by the circuit courts. And the rule is that directing a verdict at the close of the petitioner's case is structural error.
And counsel, are you familiar with Weaver versus Massachusetts decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2017?
I'm sorry, I'm not.
Okay. All right. Well, it sets up an analysis which I found very helpful in deciding when an error is structural and when it is subjected to the harmless error analysis. But please continue with your argument.
And the reason I believe this error is structural error is because a structural error affects the very mechanism of the trial mechanism. And it's not simply an error in excluding evidence. It's not an error in suppressing evidence or an error in making a ruling on the admissibility of evidence.
Counsel, could we pick up on that point just a little bit? The suppression or exclusion of evidence is subject to a harmless error review, correct?
Yes, I think it's pretty clear that those are subject to the harmless error rule.
Okay. So when you are prevented from introducing any evidence for your case, which is what occurred here, how would that be different in quality from suppression of some evidence as opposed to a difference in quantity of suppressed evidence?
The difference I see is, for example, the difference between ineffective assistance of counsel, which is subject to the harmless error rule, and complete denial of the right to counsel, which is one of the itemized errors that the courts have said is structural error. Here, C.K. was completely denied his opportunity to present a case. Now, I am aware that the Court of Appeals drew a distinction and said, well, he wasn't completely denied his right to present a defense because he was called adversely. But I think in terms of the rule that the Supreme Court should make, we shouldn't be delving into what the facts of the case are. The court should be deciding what is a good, clear rule that can be applied by the lower courts.
So let's assume, let's just take as a given that the denial went to the entire ability to put on a defense, right? So we'll set aside the fact that he was called adversely. So where do we get to a structural error? Let's say there's a case in which two items of testimony were suppressed, right? And we say, well, that's subject to harmless error. How many items of evidence have to be suppressed before we get to structural error?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I think it illustrates and supports my argument that this should be a clear rule that courts don't have to try to guess at what point this becomes structural error as opposed to simply too many errors in suppressing evidence. In this case, C.K. asked to present his defense and was completely denied. Like I wrote in my brief, that makes it difficult to even say what happened here was a trial.
Counsel, can we measure what it was that C.K. Did not get to do by what, given what occurred here?
The record in this case is virtually silent as to what C.K.'s trial counsel had in mind when he said he'd like to finish the case.
There are no other witnesses listed, though, in any disclosure for C.K. except himself, correct?
I think that's accurate, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And on speaking to that point, when I was researching this issue and how to proceed, the decision I had to make was, should I file a post-judgment motion of some kind where I try to present what C.K.'s defense would have been had he been allowed to testify? And one of the reasons I decided against that is because of the case law that I read that says when you come to the harmless error analysis, it's the burden of the beneficiary of the error to establish that it's harmless. And frankly, when I saw this, I couldn't imagine how this could not possibly be structural error because it was, in my opinion, half a trial. The trial was not even completed. A directed verdict was granted halfway through.
Well, counsel, the bare fact that a full trial did not take place is not necessarily structural error. There are circumstances in which directed verdicts are given, right?
At the close of all evidence, yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, a directed evidence or directed verdict could be requested by the defense against the prosecution after the prosecution's case, right?
I would call that a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, but yes, the case can be terminated at the close of the plaintiff's case, yes.
Right. And in a civil setting, a request for a directed verdict after the plaintiff's case has been made is a fairly common occurrence, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So just the fact that, you know, two signs were not presented does not necessarily mean that the trial did not actually take place. Isn't your argument that when the one with the burden of proof asks for the directed verdict before the other side presents a case, that's when a full trial doesn't occur?
That's correct. That's my argument is the party that the plaintiff or the petitioner that has the burden of production and the burden of persuasion, if at the close of their case they haven't presented enough evidence viewed in the light most favorable to that party, then the case should be terminated. But I think by statute the court can't grant a directed verdict in favor of the plaintiff at the close of the plaintiff's case.
Right, and that's what makes this error.
That's what makes this different, yes.
So now we have to figure out whether it's structural or harmless.
Correct.
All right. So now why can't this be fixed with a proffer of evidence, what you would have presented during your case?
Do you mean CK's case particularly or
yes.
In general?
Well, in general. In general. Because, I mean, we can look at when there is an erroneous suppression of evidence, we look at, well, what was the evidence? Right? Make a proffer. And then we can figure out whether there was harmless error.
That question is why I was so happy that the Supreme Court granted review, because in deciding how to proceed with CK, as soon as I got the case, I was sweating bullets about how to do this the right way without making CK's situation worse by making an offer of proof and things of that nature.
How would that make CK's position worse?
How would it make it worse? Mm-hmm. Well, let's just say for the sake of discussion here today that CK doesn't have any additional testimony that he could have presented that would have made his situation better. For example, good cause for abandoning his children, things of that nature. I think that would have, at least, I would have made his position worse by creating a factual record that assists the state in meeting their burden of proving harmless error. That's why, ultimately, I didn't think that was the right thing for me to do. But if it is the right thing, then I would appreciate it, and I'm sure the lower courts would appreciate it if the Supreme Court would tell us what we're supposed to do in this situation.
What do you think you should do?
I did what I thought I should do, Justice Abramson. I went ahead and I filed a notice of appeal, and the reason I thought that was the right thing to do is because I didn't want to make my client's situation worse.
I understand that.
And I sincerely believed then, and I sincerely believe now, that this ought to be structural error.
Because, what should be structural error?
The granting of a directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case without giving CK an opportunity to present his defense.
So the opportunity to defend is structural. Failure to give opportunity to defend is structural error.
That's my position? Yes. Yes.
Pardon me?
That is correct. And...
So, counsel, if we agreed that the proper procedure would be for CK to make a proffer of evidence, couldn't we then do a harmless error review? Wouldn't it be susceptible to a harmless error review?
Well, the second part of my brief, I attempted to address that. My first position is that the better rule is a clean, straight, black-letter rule that granting a directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case is structural error.
Right, and that is a really clean rule, and it may be, you know, what we need to decide. But why is that required? What about this requires us to go to the point of saying that's structural? Not just because it's clean. That's not a sufficient justification. But what takes this outside of the harmless error review? Through a proper evidence and makes it structural.
The best way I can answer that question is that a structural error is one that affects the trial mechanism. It affects the trial mechanism, and it permeates the entire procedure. And as part of researching my brief, I tried as hard as I could to find case law or statutory law that tells us what is a trial in Wisconsin, and there's surprisingly little law that says here's what a trial is. But my argument is that this wasn't actually a trial because we have what's called the adversary system, and the decision was made after only hearing half of the story, so to speak, the state's side of the story. So this wasn't a trial. It affected the trial mechanism. And without ordering CK to make a proffer of what his testimony would have been had he been given the chance, it's really difficult, if not impossible, to figure out what the prejudice was. So going back to the first question you asked, Justice Kelly, is if we were ordered to go back or remanded back to the circuit court with instructions to conduct a harmless error hearing, then the Supreme Court would have already decided that the harmless error rule does apply, and then CK could testify or present whatever additional evidence he has, and then the circuit court could make a determination of whether or not that was harmless error, whether it would have made a difference in the judge's decision.
But your more fundamental argument is that we don't even get there, right? Because I don't know that there would be a case saying, here's what a trial means. Each side gets to present its case, and that didn't happen here. So your argument is really that it's structural. I wanted to clarify, sorry, it's more of a statement than a question, but I do have a question for you based on the Chief Justice's earlier question. In fact, CLK was not the only witness on the defense witness list, right? When I reviewed the record, I think there were three witnesses listed plus all of the state's witnesses. So even though the court heard from CLK, CLK did not get his opportunity to present any of those other witnesses, right?
That is correct, and I believe your review of the record is accurate. A minute ago, I maybe misunderstood the question, but there was no indication in the record that any of those people were present. Ready to testify, and the Court of Appeals commented on that there's no reason to believe in this record that there were other witnesses. At least defense counsel didn't say, I had John Doe out in the waiting room ready to come in and testify. So the truthful answer is I don't know if there was anybody else there. It doesn't seem like there was in the record.
Do you have to treat this as if there weren't witnesses ready?
Well,
remind me, was counsel given the opportunity to say, here's who would testify in the defense? Or did the court say, no, I don't even want to hear what you have to say? Or
the way it went.
What's the record?
And I'll summarize it. I won't bore you by reading the exact transcript, but I want to just make sure I summarize it accurately. The state rested. And then defense counsel started saying something, well, I think there's at least enough here to go forward. You know, he did testify that he thought he had good cause for not communicating or visiting with the children. And then the judge sort of stopped them and said, you're arguing a motion that I suspect is going to be made, but it hasn't even been made yet. And then Mr. Westfall says, well, then I'm making the motion for a directed verdict at this point. And then as the judge started going into his comments on that, I think it occurred to a defense lawyer that maybe a directed verdict was going to be granted. And that's when he said, well, then I think I need to present the rest of my evidence. And the judge didn't comment on that. He didn't say, I'm overruling that request. He just didn't act on it.
But didn't he say, I'm going to ask to be able to put my client on the stand and finish our side of the case?
I think that's what he said, yes. He didn't say anything about other witnesses.
And then what did the judge say?
Mr. Holtzman.
The court kind of relied on abandonment, right? And then made its determination
I see what they're saying about the echo. I'm hard time hearing.
The court relied on abandonment
yes,
and made its determination and made findings in that, or not findings, but
correct.
Reached its conclusions
there
in that regard.
There was nothing said about the failure to assume, which I think was the other ground. So I plead with the court to make an order that is clear and simple that can be applied by the lower courts. The state proposes an order, you know, a ruling in the Court of Appeals to a certain extent that relies heavily on the facts of this case. So, for example, if the defendant or the respondent is called adversely and if it appears from the record that he gave all of his testimony, and if we can compare his testimony to the state's other evidence, then the harmless error rule applies because we can specifically, we can quantify the amount of prejudice. I think that's an unworkable rule, and we're getting into the situation that Justice Kelly talked about, where at what point do we reach enough error or enough prejudice that this is structural, and I just think the much clearer and the better rule is that it is flat out black letter law, structural error to grant a directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case. The reason is that is not a complete trial. That is not adversarial. The adversaries were not given an opportunity to present all of their evidence. That's a rule that makes sense to me. And I think it's a rule that the lower courts could apply, and I think it's the fair rule.
So we have the state putting in evidence, and you would not allow a directed verdict to be granted as structural. So it's now. So can it grant the directed verdict because on the basis of all the evidence?
I think by statute you can't direct...
Can or cannot?
Cannot direct a verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case. The respondent has to at least be given the opportunity and then rest.
Okay. So then the defendant is given the opportunity and says, I have no evidence. Then the court can act.
I believe so in a civil case, yes. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened here.
No, I understand that.
That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Counsel, you prepared to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Westfall, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. At counsel table with me is attorney Michael Holtzman. He is the guardian ad litem representing the best interest of the children, SMH and JEH. Mr. Holtzman is in favor of the state's position, which is that this court should affirm the lower court ruling and find that the error that occurred was subject to harmless error analysis. In this case, CLK was presented with the opportunity to testify and did so testify. His attorney was given the opportunity to question him. The erroneous grant for directed verdict only prevented CLK from taking the stand a second time and testifying again.
Counsel, let's stop right there. I think that might be kind of important. The way information comes out when you are called adversely is different from the way information comes out when you present it according to your own structure, right?
Yes.
Okay. And information that comes out perhaps disjointedly in response to the state's questions could have a different persuasive effect than, from when it was presented in a way structured by the defense. Isn't that possible?
Yes.
Okay. Why should CLK not have had the opportunity to present his evidence in his way to maximize its persuasiveness?
Yes, and Justice Kelly, the state is not alleging that this was the appropriate procedure. The state is conceding that the trial court acted in error in granting a directed verdict. The argument is that that error is subject to harmless error analyses.
Yeah, so that's the next piece of it, right? So how is one to judge the harmlessness of a defense that was never presented? Because that goes more beyond just the cold, bare statement of facts, right?
Yes.
Judge is there to assess credibility, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. And can't assess credibility when we're looking at a cold proffer of evidence, can we?
It depends on what the evidence is, Your Honor. In this case, the evidence was the testimony of CLK himself.
Okay.
As such, the court is able to assess his credibility in all the statements he made. As to other witnesses or other physical evidence?
Yeah, hang on. So the court would be able to assess his credibility when he's being questioned adversely, yeah?
When he was questioned by the state, by the guardian ad litem, and by his attorney himself.
It might look a whole lot different when the court is assessing his credibility when he's telling his own story in his own way, right?
It could be, yes.
Okay. So let's set aside that for a second and just hold on to that potentiality. Because when we're trying to figure out whether this is harmless or structural, it doesn't really matter so much what the facts in this particular case are, right?
Correct.
Okay. So just the potentiality that testimony could have a different effect when being told according to the defense's way of telling the story as opposed to the state's way of telling the story. Doesn't that tell us that's something that is not susceptible to harmless error review?
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
Why is that?
I believe that the harmless error analysis itself gives us the functionality to assess these errors through the Nelson and Hunt cases, lays out different factors this court can look at in assessing the error. Now, if we have no opportunity to understand what the defense might be, or if the court feels that it is impossible to appropriately assess what the defense or what the credibility of a witness would have been, then the court could find that that error was not harmless. However, the fact that an error would be not harmless in certain situations would not be a reason to eschew the harmless error test in all situations.
But if it's not possible, if it's not possible to capture all the nuance of live testimony in a proffer, doesn't that necessarily mean this is structural error?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question.
If it's true, I think it's true, that you can't capture all the nuance of live testimony in a proffer, then doesn't that necessarily mean that this can't be susceptible to harmless error review?
And my response, Your Honor, would be that this court has already determined in other situations regarding the denial of the right of the defendant to testify and the erroneous exclusion of testimony that those situations are subject to harmless error analyses. So this court has already found that the inability to hear the direct in-person live testimony is subject to harmless error analysis.
But this goes far beyond just denying the defendant or the respondent the right to testify or excluding or suppressing evidence. This was a complete denial of the respondent's right to put on any case at all.
And the right to present a defense is derived from the Sixth Amendment's Compulsory Process Clause, the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The right to present a defense is made up of the ability to introduce evidence, introduce testimony, to make arguments on your behalf. Each of those components is subject to harmless error per this court's prior jurisprudence.
Counsel, are you finished?
You can go ahead.
Thank you. You seem to slice and dice it, that is, each one individually that you just referenced. I note the reply brief of the respondent appellant, wherein he indicates, let's take a hypothetical. He says, for a moment, let us imagine that CLK was not called adversely by the state. Instead, the state presented its evidence, and then the judge granted the state a directed verdict without giving the defense an opportunity to present a case. So our threshold question is the error here even subject to harmless error analysis. Another way of stating that is the error here structural? In that kind of a situation, it's hard to convince me that that kind of situation should be subject to a harmless error test, whether or not it's harmless to be determined.
Structural error is that error which defies harmless error analyses and which is a defect in the trial mechanism.
Well, that's a point. Why isn't that a defect in the trial mechanism?
And that's in comparison to a trial error. Trial errors are those errors that occur during the presentation of evidence to the jury that may be quantifiably assessed in relation to other evidence to determine whether they're harmless. So in your situation, Justice Bradley, where the defendant or respondent was prevented from introducing any testimony and did not testify himself, that would still be during the presentation of the case. Whether he testified or not would still be the presentation of evidence to a jury or a fact finder. As such, that would still be in the gambit of a trial error.
So to finish then, the answer to my question, so that situation where he did not testify and was not given an opportunity to present any defense, but instead a directed verdict was granted, you're saying that's subject to the harmless error test because it's not part of the trial mechanism?
Yes, Your Honor. In the harmless error test under the Hunt and Nelson cases, two of the factors the court looks to determine whether an error is harmless is the nature of the defense. Now, in your situation, Justice Bradley, where the court was unable to ascertain the nature of the defense, that would go into whether the error was harmless or not. If the court was unable to ascertain that nature of the defense, then the court could find that the error was not a harmless error. However, that does not lead to the necessary conclusion that every time where this directed verdict is granted, that the case must necessarily be automatically reversed.
Counsel, one of the criteria that the Supreme Court has recently said when deciding whether something is subject to the harmless error is whether the effect of the error was simply too hard to measure in the case at hand. If you apply that standard, what would you think you could measure the effect of the error here, or would it be too hard to measure?
I believe the effect of the error in this case can be applied and can be assessed. Not only do we have CLK testifying in the state's case in chief, we have his testimony under examination from his attorney on two separate occasions. We have his testimony under an examination of the judge. In addition, as this is a termination of parental rights case, under the Evelyn C.R. and Stephen H. cases, the court is able to look to the entire record in making your assessment of the case. So we would look to the dispositional hearing, which occurred immediately after the grounds trial in this case. In that dispositional hearing, CLK did not call any additional witnesses outside of himself. He did not proffer any additional testimony outside of his testimony. He did not proffer any additional reason for non-contact with his children outside of what had already been presented during the grounds trial.
You know, counsel, TPRs are a little bit of a unique nature in that the jury decides certain things in a TPR trial but not other things. And then it's up to the court to make determinations regarding whether that goes forward or not and what the disposition might be. Does the fact that in a TPR jury trial, the jury is only determining whether there are grounds, and then the court takes it from there, does that play any role in our analysis in this case? And second, the fact that the court limited its determination on abandonment under the facts of this case, does that play any role in our determination?
Answering your first question first, Justice Ziegler, I do not believe the nature of a TPR trial as a bifurcated trial has an effect on the analysis. I believe the fact that the respondent has a right to present a defense is the right that is at play here. I don't believe the second phase would necessarily affect our analysis of that right, as I'm subject to harmless error analyses due to the fact that it occurs during the presentation of the case to the jury. Looking to your second question, Justice Ziegler, I believe that the fact the court only found grounds as to the abandonment claim further supports the finding that any additional testimony or evidence of CLK would not have been relevant in this case. Any additional testimony on the failure to assume parental responsibility ground would not have been relevant, as the court did not make a finding on that ground. As there is no finding on that ground, there is no grounds that were found against CLK, and such that anything he would have proffered to something that was not found against it would not be relevant.
Counsel, don't you think that this sets a bad precedent? As you know, I presided over many TPR cases and trials, and the judge presiding over these cases gets to know the case through the paperwork and through usually multiple hearings before we get to the point of a trial. And don't you think it sets a really bad precedent for if this court were to say, well, it's error, but it's okay, it's no harm, no foul, because, well, the guy didn't have a case anyway, or the mom didn't have a case anyway. Doesn't that set a dangerous precedent?
I would respectfully disagree that this is an situation where we're saying it's error, but it's okay. I think everyone would agree and understand that the error involved is a serious error. It is a constitutional error. However, this court has determined that constitutional errors can be subject to harmless error analyses, and that the strong presumption is that constitutional errors will be subject to harmless error analyses.
But isn't the essence of the state's argument that this is a no harm, no foul, because the father here didn't have a case to put on? That's the essence of your argument, as I understand it. Is that right? That's why it's harmless error?
This argument is that applying the factors in the Nelson and Hunt cases, that based upon the information we have, that the state has been able to show beyond a reasonable doubt that despite the fact of error, the result of the proceedings would not have been different.
Counsel for the respondent here cites a Seventh Circuit case, Oswald v. Bertrand, which says the Constitution requires, unless the defendant waives his rights, a certain modicum of adversary procedure, even if the outcome is a foregone conclusion. Don't you think it's a minimal element of any trial that the defendant or the respondent, particularly this is a civil case, not a criminal case, but where significant individual rights are at stake, termination of parental rights, don't you think that any respondent should have the right to put on a case, however feeble that case may be?
Yes, the state agrees that the respondent should have the right to put on the case. And that's why the state has conceded that there was error in this case, that the trial court erroneously granted a directed verdict in favor of the state. The argument the state is making is that despite that error, based upon all the evidence that had come in, the state has been able to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that even with the fact of error, that the results of the proceeding would not have been different.
But that's the point, counsel. We don't know. We really don't know what evidence the father would have put on. We can make all kinds of presumptions based on the record that he wouldn't have much to say or he wouldn't have many witnesses or any witnesses to testify, but the fact is he was not given the opportunity, so we just don't know, do we?
I would respectfully disagree. I believe we do know what Mr. CLK would have testified to based upon the fact that he did testify in the state's case, that he testified under cross-examination from his counsel. And I believe we know that there was no additional evidence or testimony that would have been put in based upon his attorney's assertion to the court that he wanted to put his client back on to complete his case. There was no indication that any additional witnesses or evidence.
And he wanted to put his client back on the stand, and there was something that followed that, yes?
And continue his case.
That could mean other witnesses.
And I believe this is, again, where we look to the Evelyn C.R. and Stephen H. cases, where the court has told us we look to the entirety of the record in making our assessments. And looking to the entirety of the record, there were no additional witnesses called by CLK.
In the disposition phase?
Correct.
The disposition followed the same day as the Grounds case, correct?
It's correct.
Before the same judge.
Before
How
the
much
same
time judge? Elapsed between the grounds phase and the disposition phase?
It was, I don't know the exact time. I believe it was in the afternoon, though, that we started. So it's either a situation where the trial ended in the morning and the dispositional immediately started at about 2 o'clock, or it was a situation where it ended in the morning, the testimony began in the morning and continued in the afternoon. I don't know the exact time frame of it, however. It was all encompassed within one day, however.
Is it possible that a witness would be relevant to the grounds phase but not the disposition?
If the argument CLK is making is that he has good cause for not having communication or contact with his children.
Let's generalize this a little bit. Is it possible that a witness could be relevant to the grounds phase of a TPR, but not the disposition?
It is possible, yes.
Okay. And do we know for certain that he didn't have any witnesses that would be applicable to the grounds phase, but not the disposition?
I believe, based upon his attorney's statement, that he just wanted to put his client back on the stand to complete his case.
And that's not what he said. He said, put his client back on and...
Complete his case.
That could be other witnesses. How do you know it wasn't?
I believe, based upon that statement, based upon looking to the entirety of the record, and the fact that there was no other witnesses present in court, there was no other indication in the record that any other witnesses were present to testify, that we can look into that record and see that there was no other testimony or evidence that would have been presented.
All right. Let's stress test your harmless error versus structural error analysis. Is your position dependent on the fact that CLK was called adversely?
No, Justice.
Okay. So even if he had not testified at all, you would say that this could still be harmless error?
Yes.
Okay. If the court had interrupted the state halfway through its case and directed a verdict, would that still be subject to a harmless error review?
I believe it would, yes.
Okay. And if the judge, the morning of the trial, came on the bench and before anything was presented, directed a verdict, would that be subject to a harmless error review?
In that situation, I do not believe so, because
why
now
not?
We're talking about a complete denial of a trial. We're
why?
No longer talking about just the introduction of evidence, because there's been no evidence or testimony that's been put in at all from any party.
Okay.
So you can't even say the trial has begun.
All right. So help me determine at what point a trial has occurred sufficient that ending it would not be structural error.
I believe once there has been a presentation to the jury, that the court is then able to look into that presentation and to quantifiably assess whether the evidence that has been introduced is able to be assessed via the harmless error analyses and whether it is able to show that the error was harmless or not. I believe that's the nature of a trial error.
So if the outcome is a foregone conclusion in the eyes of a trial court, the trial court in this context, or perhaps even in a criminal context, can just say, sorry, Mr. Defendant or Mr. Respondent, you don't get to put your case on. I'm ruling in favor of the state, and that's not structural?
It would depend on the point of error. One of the aspects of looking to structural versus trial error is looking at whether the error permeated the entire trial process or whether it occurred at a discrete point in time.
Well, some would say that not being able to present a defense, that eliminates one half of a trial. Yeah?
And
well, certainly a defendant's right to testify is also constitutional, but this court has upheld preventing a defendant from testifying, correct?
That's correct. In the State versus Nelson case, this court did hold the right to testify.
Clearly that we have a constitutional problem here, but the state has conceded error. I think the question is, what's the framework under which we decide whether or not this error is subject to a harmless error analysis, correct?
Yes, Justice.
Okay.
Did you finish Justice Kai's question?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the whole
which
question,
one?
Justice.
I'm sorry, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, were you asking a question?
No. You had asked a question, and then someone
She thought I asked a question, and he hadn't answered yours. And if I have,
I apologize. Please answer whatever he asked you that you didn't answer.
Well, now that's escaped my mind because I have a question I'd rather ask at this point.
That's fine.
So, I think the steps, half a step back at least. So I want to know a little bit more about at what point a foreshortening of a trial creates structural error as opposed to harmless error. So is it your position that the judge subjectively determines whether he has enough evidence and that if he thinks he does and he ends the trial, that that's subject to harmless error?
Yes. Once the evidence has begun being introduced, we now have the introduction of evidence that's occurring during the presentation of the case to the jury. That is the hallmark of trial court error. The fact that the case has begun now puts us to a place where we can point to a discrete point in time where the error would occur, and we can assess that error.
So if the if that's the analysis, then a judge who really doesn't want to go through a trial could let the first witness state his first sentence, end it, and say, I have enough evidence. And now that's subject to harmless error.
It would be subject to harmless error. However, that would very likely be found not to be harmless, because the court would be unable to assess whether the amount of evidence that came in comparison to the Hunt and Nelson factors, would point to whether it was harmless or not.
Okay.
So
if the structural error, though, is an error in the mechanism of the trial,
yes,
then don't you have to conclude that the judge allowing one sentence of testimony from the first sentence is actually a trial?
Yes, I believe with the definition that this court has used for structural error and trial error being that error that occurs during the presentation of the case to the jury and that may be quantifiably assessed via other evidence to determine whether it's harmless, I believe once we begin to put in that evidence, we are now in the gambit of that trial error. That is why we will look to the harmless error analyses.
Again, you're comfortable saying a one-sentence statement from a witness is a trial.
I'm comfortable saying that that is the beginning of the trial, not that a trial has been completed, and that once that has happened, if there is an error in granting the verdict, then that would be subject to the harmless error analysis.
Justice Kelly, are you finished? I have a few questions I'd like to ask. Okay. One of the criteria from Weaver is being able to measure the effect of the error. So we all know there's error here. And Justice Kelly's question about staying one sentence, and that would be the end of the situation and nothing else could be presented, would that make it more difficult to measure than what occurred here or not?
That would make it more difficult to measure.
And another thing that the Supreme Court has said we should look at is the issue for which we are considering assessment for whether it's subject to harmless error, designed to protect some interest other than the defendant's. Could you think about that a little bit? And is the interest that's being raised by opposing counsel of a directed verdict at this point, where the defendant has given evidence but not been permitted to be led through his testimony by his own attorney, designed to protect some interest other than CK's interest?
I believe in the situation before us that the only interest designed to be protected would be CLK's interest. As we do have his testimony, this is the case involving his rights. And so the individuals outside of CLK, I don't believe their interest would be at issue in the case we have before us.
Counsel, references made to the 2017 United States Supreme Court case of Weaver versus Massachusetts, and references made for the premise that a factor to consider when determining whether harmless error analysis is appropriate is whether it's too difficult to assess the effect. I'm paraphrasing now. That was offered in this court in 2014 in the Nelson case, and the dissent in paragraph 79, which states, the error in the present case defies harmless error review. It is too difficult to determine the effect of a defendant's taking or not taking the stand on the trial's outcome. That, of course, was dealing with the Nelson case and the Nelson facts. Is that the test, that a test, a factor that you think this court should now consider? In other words, whether it presents too difficult, it is too difficult to determine the effect of the error?
Now, in the Nelson case, the court did lay out several factors that can be looked at.
This was in the dissent, not in the majority opinion, 79.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor. With that, I believe that even though this would be difficult to assess, that does not make it impossible to assess, does not make it incapable of assessment. We have the majority decision that did lay out the different factors the court can look to, one of those factors being the nature of the defense. So I believe the court is able to look at that nature of the defense, look at the evidence and testimony that has come in as compared to that which we do not know, and then make the assessment on whether the error was harmless or not. The state's position is that even though it may be difficult, it is not the appropriate avenue to completely disregard the harmless error test and say that it is always structural error. A trial court needs to be able to be the gatekeeper of evidence in any case they have. They should not be in the position where they would be in fear of an automatic reversal for not allowing in certain pieces of testimony or evidence. If there were a situation like in Nelson where the court restricted the defendant from testifying, were that to be found to be structural error, then the trial court, doing its best job and trying to manage its calendar and be the gatekeeper of evidence, would be put in the untenable position that they would not be able to meet those goals. So it is the state's position that the error would still be capable of assessment, and that while the difficulty in assessing, that would be something that would go into the analysis of whether it was harmless error or not, not into whether it is structural.
Counsel, the court in Weaver said that the purpose of the structural error doctrine is to ensure insistence on certain basic constitutional guarantees that should define the framework of any criminal trial. Again, we're in a civil context, but where fundamental rights are at stake. So the struggle that I have is even getting to the harmless error analysis in the first place, because again, without regard to the outcome, in my mind, there was a framework that should be observed in every single trial. A defendant, a respondent, should be able to put on his case, and that was completely denied. So how do you square your position with the purpose of the structural error doctrine as articulated by the United States Supreme Court?
Well, I believe the United States Supreme Court is also in the Crane versus Kentucky case, ruled when discussing the right to present a defense, that in the last paragraph of that decision, it did note that harmless error does apply to that situation. They do agree to that. I believe the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in the State versus Kramer case have also held that the right to present a defense is subject to harmless error. The fact that there was an inability to put forth a defense, I do not believe is an error in the trial mechanism. Looking to the definition of structural error and harmless error from both the U.S. Supreme Court and this Supreme Court, the right to present a defense is, in essence, I see my time is...
You may finish your answer.
The right to present a defense is, in essence, the ability to introduce testimony and evidence and arguments on your behalf. That's the compulsory process clause and the 14th Amendment's due process clause. The ability to put in that testimony, that evidence, is putting in information before the jury. That is what has been defined as trial error, which has been called the hallmark of harmless error analysis. For all these reasons, I do ask that this court affirm the lower court's rulings. Thank you.
Listening to the court's discussion with Mr. Westfall has really solidified in my mind the idea that this is harmless error. The example of where the defendant...
It is harmless?
Is error? Structural error.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure you wanted to say that.
Is
structural
error.
You thought you were
going to
make the case easy. And,
yeah, that's right. You're confessing error, huh?
Yes, I am not. Thank you for fixing that for me. It would be embarrassing. Is structural error, and the reason is the example of the defendant who doesn't testify at all in the state's case and then is not given the opportunity to testify in his own case because of the directed verdict.
Well, except in a criminal case, the state can't call the defendant in their
Correct.
Case in chief, so there's a pretty functional difference there. Does ineffective assistance of counsel have any play in this case? I mean, where was counsel's objection? Your Honor, I want to make a record. Where was the, you know, if allowed to, we would present evidence that would show boom, 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 boom. Where is that? And shouldn't we take a look at that, or should we skip over that?
Well, I did look at it concerning trial counsel, and I concluded that his statement that I want to continue my case was sufficient to preserve the error. If you're talking about me, why didn't I file a motion, a post-judge?
No, I'm not necessarily. I mean, you could have done a variety of things potentially, but what I'm wondering is why shouldn't we look through the lens of ineffective assistance? Counsel should have demanded to make a record on what. And if the court said, no, I won't even let you make a record of what you would introduce as testimony, does that factor in at all here?
Yes, it does. And it tells me that this is structural error, because in the situation where the defendant or the respondent is not called in the petitioner's case, so in other words, there's no testimony from the respondent, and then he's not given the opportunity to present the case, he's faced with a dilemma. If he does nothing in the trial court and files a notice of appeal, well, then the harmless error is easy. It's made for the state. They have no burden because we don't know what the respondent's testimony would be. Or he does what I considered doing, which was file a post-judgment motion with affidavits and maybe even testimony. But I think he's still harmed because the judge is not deciding the case based on hearing the petitioner's testimony and then hearing the respondent's testimony. The judge is viewing it in this through this lens of finality and asking the question, is what the respondent presented here as his proffer, would that have been enough to change my mind? And it's even worse if it was a jury. The judge is faced with the question, is what the respondent presenting in his proffer, would have that have been sufficient to change the jury's verdict? And we don't really know what the jury thought was important.
But counsel, this was a bench trial, wasn't it?
Right, it was a bench
trial.
Okay,
well, don't we need, I mean, maybe there would be different circumstances if we had a jury, but this was to a judge, correct?
Right, but I think we should strive to create a rule that applies in all situations, otherwise.
Well, sometimes jury trials are different than bench trials for a lot of reasons.
Right. So the.
But should it be different here?
I don't think it should be different.
And why not?
Because if it's structural error, that's a question of law. If it's structural error, it shouldn't matter if it's a jury or a court trial, because we're not going to even consider the effect that it may have had on the verdict or in the case of the judge's decision.
Which is why it's an advisory verdict, mm-hmm. does that play a role in the structural error analysis?
So to answer the question is, I don't think it should make a difference if it was a jury trial or a court trial. I was just merely saying that it becomes even muddier if a jury is involved, because the judge knows what he or she was thinking in making the decision, but we don't really know what a jury thought was important in reaching its verdict. So I think it's structural error.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for a very interesting case and good arguments and good briefs. You are always a great deal of help to the court as we try to sort through all of this. We are going to take a brief recess so that the next group can come in and you can leave us. So we are adjourned.